In central Wisconsin, major flooding is occurring along the Wisconsin River. We're getting an update on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Residents along the river in Columbia and Sauk counties have started evacuating due to flood water. The National Weather Service says the river crested at Portage Sunday night, slowly expected to drop back to flood stage by the end of the week. What's happening in your area? Are the rivers in your community nearing or at flood stage? How are you coping with an influx of showers and storms this week? The number to share your weather story is 800-642-1234. Let's get an update now from Max Saperis. He's a meteorologist for WKOW-TV in Madison. Max, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, where do we stand when it comes to storms and showers? What kind of activity are we seeing on the radar?
Well, in general, today we're in a quieting trend, and that's good because yesterday, of course, was very active for most of the state, especially central and southern Wisconsin, got in on lots of rain and storms. But overall, now most of the wet weather has exited, and we're dealing with a, again, quieting trend. We'll see increasing sun through the day, but that's only going to be a temporary reprieve. We're expecting more light rain Thursday and then possibly a storm system this weekend. Which could bring possibly snow to northern Wisconsin. Not set in stone yet, but of course the active weather pattern continues with just little dry days in between.
Well, in terms of rainfall totals, where do we stand?
Rainfall totals overall, it's easy just to really compare things to average since we're talking statewide here. Over the last 3 months, the entire state of Wisconsin does have above average precipitation by at least an inch or two. But you go farther north and in central and parts of northern Wisconsin, they're running 4 to 12 inches above average. Again, that's just specifically with their liquid equivalent of snowfall and, of course, with the liquid precipitation as well. And the fact that we had that huge April snow system that brought up to a foot of snow near Wausau and Eau Claire, all that is now just making its way down the river. It's that annual migration of the water down the river. But it just seems to be worse this year. And it has a lot to do with the fact that we never really dried off from last year with all the wet weather we received with that historic flooding in the late summer and the fall, of course, as we all remember.
How is this affecting our rivers right now? What are you watching closely here?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's always the ebbs and flows of the news coverage through the spring. But right now what we're seeing is the worst is over for the Wisconsin rivers as you go through Juneau and down into Sauk County and Columbia County, too. So, but, of course, it's still close to the crest that you just mentioned that happened on Easter. And that was just a half foot away from their record set back in 2010. So these are not distant memories that we're going back to recall that historic flooding. This is really recent stuff here. So that was at 20.1 feet this weekend. But now it's falling slowly but surely. Still, though, even today in the major flood stage, by tomorrow it'll be in the moderate flood stage, the Wisconsin River, specifically in Portage. And that will continue to fall by next weekend below flood stage. So the Wisconsin River is going to see some serious improvements as we go this week. But of course, it flows downstream, and that causes more problems for the Mississippi River. So this is just going to be one thing after another until we can finally enter into a drier pattern. And of course, until and right now we deal with that snow melt. So it's just, we just can't catch a break, can we, Kate?
Well, you segue right into Mississippi. What does Mississippi flooding look like? I know I was in the Quad Cities recently, and I had a lot of difficulty getting from the Illinois side of the river to the Iowa side of the river. I mean, so many roads blocked off.
Yeah, I know. And everyone really on the upper Mississippi is dealing with that flooding, specifically along the Wisconsin border. The spine in the Mississippi River there. That right now is in the minor to moderate flood stage for the entire stretch of the west side of Wisconsin. But of course, as I mentioned before, especially the southern end of the Mississippi River on Wisconsin is going to be rising as the Wisconsin River flows into it. So again, all these riverways connect, right? So the Mississippi River over at Jamestown, so that's closer to Dubuque on the other side of the river, That's expected to rise to 22 feet this Saturday, and that's back into the major flood stage. And again, Kate, these are areas that already had major flooding within the last month or so, and they're going to experience major flooding again this weekend. And this all has to do with just the fact that we've been so wet, and again, that snow system that we got at the beginning of the month. So Jamestown, you'll be at flooding, at major flooding by Saturday. And at Prairie du Chien, so across the river from Gutenberg, that's where the gauge is, you'll be up to 22.9 feet by Friday. And you're still about 3 feet from the record. So we're not talking historically high crests like what we saw on the Wisconsin River over in Portage, which was, again, a half foot away from the record. But still, major flooding, and they already dealt with one of these major crests already. And that'll happen this weekend. And, of course, you reach your crest, and then it still takes a week or two for those waters to get back to normal levels. So it's going to be a really slow process, and something that your heart breaks because you hear all these conversations, or you have all these conversations with people that are affected. And a lot of them are saying, oh, we took on water just as recently as months ago. And just to see it happen again is really tough to see.
Talking with Max Saperis, he's a meteorologist at WKOW-TV in Madison, looking at flooding in Wisconsin and area states and getting a forecast of what's to come. Max, when we see day after day of rainfall, perhaps in the forecast here, consecutive days, does that have an impact on the water level in the rivers, or is it more of this upstream snowmelt that is the bigger issue?
Yeah, Kate, you know, it all goes together, right? But the snow melt is really what was driving the rise in the waters. And I think the easiest way to describe it is the rain is really just adding insult to injury and causing the slower falling process. So the computer models and the River Forecast Center, they update these graphs that show how long it takes through time for the rivers to rise and fall. And as I've been checking over the last couple of days, let's talk specifically on the Wisconsin River at Portage. Because of the rain that we got yesterday, which was, again, about an inch to, or I'm sorry, a half inch to an inch across the board, and hot spots got more. And we actually just had a flood watch in northeast Wisconsin from Stevens Point up to Green Bay. That has expired. That's canceled, rather, because, of course, the rain is done. But what that allows to happen is a slower fall. So I've been seeing that the Wisconsin River at Portage has been holding in the major flood stage for a little bit longer than what the initial forecasts were trying to depict. And that's because of the additional rainfall that we're receiving. So luckily, Thursday doesn't look like too big of a deal with our next little rain system. But this weekend, yeah, Saturday, we could have more high liquid precipitation totals out of that.
Well, let's segue from liquid precipitation over to can any one of us get a little bit of heat here? We would love some spring. we did get a hint of spring this past weekend. When will temperatures start to warm up?
Yeah, Madison saw their first 80 degree temperature reading, and that was on of the year. Yep, that was on Sunday. So yeah, we're gonna get back to 80 anytime soon, especially in southern Wisconsin, where we're just tasting spring a little more consistently now than farther north, right? Big old state. So it looks like we're just going to be in a milder stretch here. We really got our taste this past weekend, and now it's going to be more seasonal. So at least in southern Wisconsin today, more like around 60 versus the 70s of yesterday. And then we'll kind of have these little ups and downs, but no serious warm-up. And the reason why is because of the active pattern, which just tends to, as the little cold fronts slip through, they just reinforce the milder trend. So nothing cold for sure, but also looks like it will be a more of a milder week and more seasonal for the rest of the week. But of course, as I mentioned, though, Kate, as we go into this weekend, this is not set in stone by any stretch of the imagination, but there is a chance that we could get at least some snow in far northern Wisconsin as another low pressure system moves in. Of course, just all depends on the track, but it could be another active weekend. And of course, when you mention snow, that doesn't sound like a warm day either.
not going in the right direction, Max.
No, but we'll
have
it's springtime in Wisconsin. Yep.
We'll have to end it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Max Zaparis is a meteorologist at WKOW-TV in Madison. We've been talking about flooding along the Wisconsin River and forecasts looking ahead. Coming up, we're talking about pet rescues in distress situations like puppy mills with the head of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Have you ever adopted a rescue animal before? What was the process like? How did the animal change your life? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking pet rescues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this comes after news that dogs from a South Korean meat farm made their way to Wisconsin earlier this year. For decades now, South Korea has been at the center of a cultural debate over this long custom of consuming dog meat, but the practice is in decline. We're talking about adopting animals out of distressed conditions like puppy mills, like meat farms, and natural disasters. Humane Society International estimates that more than 200,000 dogs are ordered online and shipped into the U.S. each year from puppy mills across the world. Have you ever adopted a rescue animal? What's the process like? Are you taking care of a quarantined rescue dog here in Wisconsin? What's your situation? We're at 800-642-1234. Anne Reed is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Anne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, before we talk about rescuing dogs from South Korea, let's talk about the animals that end up in the care of the Wisconsin Humane Society. What is their story? Where do they typically come from?
Sure. What people need to know first is that every local and regional humane society, and there are about 50 throughout the state, are separate from each other and separate from any national. And it's just the historic truth of the work is that we've all grown up separately. So at the Wisconsin Humane Society, through some combination of those organizations, we're operating in Racine, Milwaukee, Ozaukee, Brown, and Door counties. And animals come to us. We're bringing in about 16,000 animals a year, and they're coming to us from all different sources. First of all, it is our primary obligation to serve families in the communities we serve, and that's true of other humane societies throughout the state as well. So if someone needs to give up their animal, we're always here for them. In most of the cities where we work, we're also taking in stray animals and animals who are seized by law enforcement. But because of the wonderful fact that animal homelessness is really falling throughout the northern United States, we're able to help others as well. So we do take animals from shelters in the south, and as we see in this story, some other organizations in Wisconsin, not as it happens the Wisconsin Humane Society, took these dogs from Korea through Humane Society International.
So in February, this happened where a couple dozen dogs were rescued from this meat farm in South Korea, brought to Wisconsin. What did this process of taking them out of the country look like, and who was behind that mission?
So the Humane Society of the United States, again, not directly connected to any Wisconsin organization, has an arm called Humane Society International, and they are very focused on the situation of animals in other countries. That's their primary focus. And so they've been very focused on South Korea. It's a very complicated situation. Significant scale farming of dogs is never good. It's just never a good situation. And I understand that there are a number of these farmers in Korea who would like to get out of that work and need places to put their animals. On the other hand, it's complicated because of the logistics, and as we saw here, you just get a different kind of way you need to manage disease and look at disease than you do for domestic animals.
Well, during this rescue mission, two of the rescues tested positive with an infection. What do we know about brucellosis?
Brucellosis was the infection that these two dogs tested positive for. It's a bacteria. It affects among animals, dogs only. The issue is that it can be transmitted to people, and therefore the state is taking it extremely seriously. It doesn't actually shorten life or cause suffering, but it does cause reproductive infections that are significant, of course, and it's very, very rarely, but it's possible, transmitted to people. So these dogs came into six other organizations in Wisconsin, not the Wisconsin Humane Society, and that is what really created the opportunity. When the state very appropriately ordered that all 26 Korean dogs and any domestic dogs that had happened to be in the shelter with them, essentially wrong place at the wrong time, all be isolated until the testing for the Korean dogs panned out, we at the Wisconsin Humane Society were able to offer our shelter in Door County to take about 25 dogs, which was about half of the total dogs being quarantined. And that really allowed our friends at Hawes and Waukesha and Sheboygan Humane.
And I think we've just lost Ann Reed. She is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. We've been talking about rescue animals and dogs taken from a South Korean meat farm that have made their way to Wisconsin earlier this year, and the process of taking dogs from other countries and from disaster areas, from puppy mills as well. And Humane Society International estimates that more than 200,000 dogs are ordered online and shipped into the U.S. each year from puppy mills all over the world. And you have probably had the situation where you've had a rescue animal rescued from an environment that perhaps was a natural disaster, like a hurricane or a tornado area. We've been looking at rescue missions from abroad and a couple animals being tested positive for brucellosis, which is found in breeding operations in the U.S. that are substandard. It's a rare disease, typically most common in substandard breeding operations. It's passed through birthing fluids and tissue. And because of that risk, these rescue animals that were in Wisconsin shelters were quarantined. And we are looking at what this process looks like as you move animals from different shelters that are quarantined, dogs from South Korea being quarantined in their adopted homes. And new owners are doing that in the Sheboygan County area. And this particular situation is not unique, as the Humane Society International works abroad and has brought these animals to the U.S. to be able to be eventually adopted out, but with a lot of precautions. And so as we look at that, we're looking at, a range of issues when you bring in animals from other countries and animals from these environments. So maybe you have had the situation. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Anne, are you there?
I'm back.
Oh, okay, so sorry about that. So in the face of disasters like, I know, Hurricane Katrina and the Joplin tornado, California wildfires, when do Wisconsin shelters join the effort to rescue animals in these situations?
Almost always, and these partnerships are so important. What's important in all those kinds of situations is you actually don't want to take the animals that are made homeless by the disaster, and they need to be right where they are because they have people who love them looking for them. The important thing is to take animals who are already in shelter in those places, and time has passed, they're ready to be adopted by someone else, and get those animals out so that shelters in the location are clear. And nearly every shelter in Wisconsin is actively doing that when disasters come.
Well, certainly that animal's been under a lot of stress in an environment where there's been stress, there's been movement, maybe they've been transported to different areas. How can families help that animal find stability?
So animals are really incredibly resilient, but you're right that they still need as much stability as they can. And we just, both with our foster volunteers and our adopters, the way they support each other in finding ways just to create quiet and calm primarily and a predictable routine every day, you're right, it's very important.
So when a veterinarian starts taking a look at a rescue animal, do you approach rescue animal adoption in a different way?
You know, I really recommend that people don't. The first place you should go when you acquire a new animal is your veterinarian. And I think it's really helpful to animals and to that veterinary relationship if you take the relationship as new wherever you acquired that animal from. I hope you didn't get it from a pet store. That's just a terrible idea. A rescue or shelter adopting from a pet store is great. The pet store itself buying animals and selling them is awful for several reasons. But wherever you got the animal from, let your vet know that, and let your veterinarian make those medical judgments about what needs to be looked at. And coming to it with no preconceptions really is a good idea.
There are thousands of adoptions every year at the Wisconsin Humane Society. How have you seen pet adoption evolve since the 1970s when the shelter opened?
What a great question. In the 80s and 90s, we had to work hard to convince people that shelter animals were healthy, safe to be around, that shelter animals essentially were great and not flawed. Fast forward to today, wonderfully, we still have lots of great, healthy animals with no problems, but sometimes our longest lines are for animals with medical problems, for a dog with three legs, for a cat with one eye, for a cat who's not allowed to be in a home with other cats. Those are the people, those are the animals for whom people's hearts really come forward, and we're amazed at people's desire to help the animals most in need.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Anne Reed is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society, and we've been talking about how to safely adopt rescue animals that come from distressed environments. Coming up, we explore whether more self-reliance and local community initiatives can better solve societal problems than sweeping national policy efforts. It's a conversation about the upside of less government, not more, with your thoughts along the way. Stay with us right here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the impact of local governance on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Recent polling tells us that Americans' trust in the federal government's ability to get things done and solve real challenges has sunk to the lowest point in more than two decades. Like the decline in trust, the rise in polarization is real and it's intertwined. And we're hearing a case for more grassroots, local control of government to solve big problems rather than rely on the federal government. Have you recently lost trust in our government? Why did you change your mind? What were your reasons? You can email ideas@wpr.org. Rick Graber is president and CEO of the Bradley Foundation. That's a private grant-making organization based in Milwaukee. And he recently wrote an op-ed in The Hill titled, "Washington Can't Solve Our Problems, But Civil Society Can." Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks very much, Kate. Nice to be with you.
Well, this recent Gallup poll found that Americans' trust in government to handle both domestic and international problems is really eroding. Just 35% of respondents said they trust the government to handle domestic issues. 41% said they don't trust the government to handle international issues. You say, you look at these numbers and you say that's encouraging. How so?
You know, one of the strengths of this country always has been our civil society. I think it's something that has distinguished this country. I think it's something that's made this country exceptional. And when I talk about civil society, I'm really talking about neighborhoods and churches and schools and private voluntary organizations. It's those organizations at the local level that are best equipped to deal with the problems facing our society. It's not more government. It's not more government programs that over time have proven not to be as effective as people helping people.
So at that local level, the schools, the churches, the volunteer organizations, the grant-making organizations, how are they more likely to guide our behaviors and actually make a difference in people's lives?
Well, I look at a number of the organizations that the Bradley Foundation provides resources to. It's organizations that are dealing with the drug problem, with alcohol addiction, with opioid addiction. It's organizations that are helping people achieve the dignity that comes from home ownership. It's organizations that are helping people coming out of the criminal justice system find a job. Those aren't government organizations doing that, but those are organizations that very quietly are making a difference in our community. And it's not just in Milwaukee, it's all over the country.
And you say that our commitment to civil society has really been a hallmark of our country. When you say civil society, what do you mean by that?
Kind of what I said at the outset. When we talk about civil society, we're talking about those organizations, those institutions outside of government that have really formed the glue of our country, families, churches, neighborhoods, private voluntary organizations. And I saw it very clearly. I lived and worked in Europe for 6 years. And while we loved our time living overseas, it was really apparent to me that there's just a different DNA, a different culture when it comes to giving of time and giving of resources that I think really distinguishes this country. That's what we're good at. That's what we were founded upon. And that's what's made this country great over time.
And how do you see a link with this American exceptionalism? Where do you go there?
I believe that this is an exceptional country. I believe that this is a unique country. And the reason that we have been able to achieve that position within the world over these years under an incredible constitution is because of a strong civil society, because of a commitment to the constitutional order that our founders created. It's because of our commitment to free markets and to an informed and capable citizenry. All of that combined, I think, has made this country unique, and I think it's something that we've got to work to defend and protect going forward.
And this American exceptionalism really depends on encouraging this self-government governance you
Absolutely.
Talk about and engaging
Absolutely.
Communities. How can we do that today, especially when you consider the level of political polarization that's really become the norm?
Not easy. I mean, I wish there was a silver bullet. I wish I could give you an answer and tomorrow it'd be fixed. It's just a day-by-day effort. It's people listening to people, not being afraid to have a discussion, to have a civil disagreement about something. We've lost so much of that today. Everything's a fight. Everything is polarizing. Part of it is contributed to by media on both sides of the political spectrum. I think we got to stop it. And I think we got to be able to listen to each other. I think at times we've got to be willing to compromise. There's just not enough of that today. But it takes every single person to buy into that and to do their best.
How can lawmakers buy into that?
Well, lawmakers are contributing to the polarization. Again, we see it every day. It's politicians wanting to watch themselves on TV. It's politicians not being willing to focus on really the big problems facing our country. So much of what we're hearing today are political gamesmanship when we've got huge problems in this country to deal with: our debt, our entitlement programs, our tax policy, so much of what government is dealing with is on the fringes right now and not really tackling the tough problems that people were elected to tackle.
We're talking with Rick Graber. He's president and CEO of the Bradley Foundation. That is a grant-making organization based in Milwaukee, looking at the impact of local governments to solve larger issues that perhaps the national government could step back from. And we're looking at this through the lens of an op-ed piece he recently wrote for The Hill. Rick, next month is the Bradley Prizes, which is your foundation's annual awards ceremony, and the award goes to people whose work reflects the foundation's mission to strengthen and protect the principles of American exceptionalism. How can someone reflect that ideology in a really tangible way?
Well, I think if you look at our three award winners this year, each of them has done that in different ways. One is Judge Janice Rogers Brown, who was a circuit court judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. Her adherence to the rule of law, to our constitutional order, really brings that out. Jim Grant, who's a founder and editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, just an outstanding financial journalist, financial historian, again, focuses on that free markets aspect that is so important to our success in this country. And then Roger Kimball, who's the editor of New Criterion and publisher of Encounter Books, dealing with creating a more informed and capable citizenry, contributing to that civil society that we were talking about. So our three winners do it in different ways, but they've all contributed greatly to what it has taken to make this country great.
And each winner receives $250,000 and can spend it however they wish. What do winners typically do with this money, with a stipend?
You know, we don't ask. Some give it back in some way. Some, you know, perhaps help pay for their kids' college education. It really is entirely up to the winners to do with it as they will.
Why does the Bradley Foundation want to put together a ceremony like this?
It's a celebration. It's an annual celebration in our nation's capital, celebrating the principles that I've been talking about this morning, celebrating some incredible individuals that have done great, great work on behalf of our country in a very unselfish way. It's a time to bring together a community, and it really is a wonderful, wonderful evening each and every year. This will be our 16th, so it's great fun.
So as we look at this Pew data showing that public trust in government is near historic lows, and this decline of faith in government intersects with a separate trend, which is rising partisanship. Do you see these two trends interconnected?
I think they are. I think people are frustrated with federal government. They see that federal government has not been able to solve problems. I think they see politicians that just seem to be into it for the political gamesmanship of it, or the gotcha politics that we see in today's world. We don't see them as being part of the solution. So what I've offered in my op-ed is an alternative, and that's thinking real hard about who's best suited to solve the problems facing our society. Is it big government in Washington, or is it not? We have a system of federalism in this country. We have a system of separation of powers, and to some extent we've gotten away from that. More of government seems to be centered in Washington as opposed to the states. I think in large respect the executive branch of our government in Washington has too much power. I think some of that has been abdicated by the Congress. So getting back to those core principles, our founding fathers were smart guys. They came up with an incredible system that has worked now for centuries. Refocusing, rededicating ourselves to that. And then, of course, as I said in the first place, in some cases, it's not government at all. It's just people helping people to restore the dignity that comes from work. Every single person should be respected and have dignity in our society. And that's aspirational, I understand, but it's something we should work towards every day.
Well, federal budgets are built, debated, passed. State governments are built, debated, passed. How do you transfer more power locally when the bureaucracy of it all is very much cemented in dates and time?
If I understand your question correctly, part of the problem that I see in these budgets, both in Washington and in states, is an unwillingness of politicians to face the tough questions. First of all, living within your means. We're spending too much in this country. That's very clear. I don't think we're undertaxed. There are plenty of taxes that flow into the state coffers, but we're not making the hard decisions. People don't like to talk about it, but our entitlement system is something that needs to be reformed. It's not sustainable. We've seen what happens in Europe, for instance, when government pays for everything forever. It just doesn't work. And our politicians have to face that reality and deal with that reality in a way that's responsible to the people that are paying the bills.
We're talking about the size and role of government, the impact of local governance. Rick Graber is our guide. He's president of the Bradley Foundation. And you can explore your own questions. Are you a member of a local institution, such as a school or a voluntary association? What problems have you solved in your community? Should people rely on you more than the federal government? You can email ideas at WPR.org, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the size and role of government and its impact on communities. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republicans in the past have argued that unrestrained spending and particularly unreformed entitlement programs will saddle our country with out-of-control debt in coming decades. And there's more to this, that there's a sentiment that a large, intrusive federal government not only undermines the private economy, but also crowds out civil society and civic character, prevents communities from pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. What do you think? Do you believe the U.S. is faced with political polarization? What issues do you believe divide us? What are your thoughts on federal budget and government spending? What is our government doing right now when it comes to spending? How can the government improve its spending habits? Email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking about this with Bradley Foundation CEO Rick Graber, and he recently wrote about local governance in an op-ed in The Hill. Rick, heading into the 2020 presidential campaign, it seems that we're living in an era of extreme political polarization, and according to a recent survey from the Public Religion Research Institute, 91% of the country is divided over politics. So how do you see this playing out as we head into 2020?
Your guess is as good as mine. It's going to be fascinating. Obviously, our president is a controversial figure. I don't think that's going to change. But what you see on the Democratic side, and again, I'm speaking personally now, Bradley Foundation does not get into politics, but from a personal perspective, what I see it is a Democratic Party that's moving far to the left with the likes of Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, and the list goes on for many more names I don't see in the short term that polarization or that divide narrowing at all. And I think it's too bad. I don't think our country was built on the principles being espoused by Senator Sanders and other of, in effect, socialism, of government taking care of everything. That's just contrary to all at least that I was talking about earlier today, the importance of people helping people and not so reliant on a top-down government knows best kind of system. One thing I will say is good, though. I'm very pleased that the Democrat National Convention will be in Milwaukee. I think it's great for the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin.
In your backyard, right.
Well, absolutely.
Last year, you said conservative values were gaining momentum across America when we last spoke. And do you think conservative values are still on the rise?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I see it in the organizations that we fund. We talked about volunteerism being up in this country, philanthropy being up. That's unique to America, and I think those are core conservative values. This notion that in the polls that we talked about today, that there's just lack of trust or lack of belief that government can solve all problems, to me is bringing us to a point where, all right, how do we solve these problems? If government can't do it, then we've got to do it ourselves, and that should be the default in the first place.
Well, let's look at the federal budget and government spending. The deficit is projected to rise, and the national debt has topped $22 trillion. Some in Washington are calling for a balanced budget amendment. What do conservatives have to say about all of this?
I think conservatives believe that there's too much spending. I mean, just look at the average business or the average household. You have to spend within your means. But it gets back to the point that I was making earlier. There are some fundamental questions that are just not being addressed. Paul Ryan tried years ago. No one would listen. But until we deal with entitlement spending, till we deal with Social Security, these issues that no one wants to talk about, we got a problem. There's no amount of tinkering that you can do with what's left in the budget to solve the problem unless you deal with this. We've got an aging population in this country. The problem's only going to get worse, and I would urge our politicians, our elected officials, to focus on this, even though it's not easy, and even though some are going to violently disagree with whatever position you take on it.
And earlier this month, we saw House Democrats scrapping a plan to vote on a measure that would have relaxed spending caps for the discretionary parts of the federal budget for the next couple years. Do you see lawmakers on the same page regarding spending and where the deficit is going?
No, I don't think Democrats focus on it at all. And regrettably, I don't think Republicans are as focused as they should be. I mean, they often talk about the need to control spending, but when it comes right down to it, there aren't enough of our elected officials willing to take the tough steps, take the tough votes to get where we need to get and to preserve this country the way it is. And yeah, it does have an economic impact at some point if our government spending debt is out of control. It can't help but have an impact on the economy. And that's really what our founding fathers at the Bradley Foundation thought about. Lyndon and Harry Bradley, two brothers who grew up in Milwaukee, built the Allen Bradley Company, which is probably known to many of your listeners. They did it at a time and in a way when there was limited government interference with their efforts to build a company. And there were times when they almost went bankrupt. They had successes, they had stops, they had starts, but in the end, they built an incredible company. That should be the opportunity available to everyone.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to Jeremy in Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm glad you're
good. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, how are you? I'm glad you discussed the demographics that are coming down the pipelines. In the next 3-4 years, people are really going to get a rude awakening in regards to what the baby boomers contributed to the economy, especially the financial sectors. They're no longer going to be putting money into the economy. They're going to be drawing from their pension plans, Social Security, and things like that. And that's going to be a very big burden on Gen X's and the millennials coming down the pipes. And I don't think they're ready for it. And I'd like to see politicians begin discussing that in public education in regards to what is going to be expected from us, because it's going to be a massive shock to the economy and people's pocketbooks. They really don't realize that it's coming, and it will come.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Rick, what is it going to take to get the budget under control, and who is responsible as the burden shifts to Gen X and millennials?
I would hope it would be responsible politicians dealing with a problem that, as Jeremy points out, is coming down the track probably more quickly than we'd all like. I'm afraid that it might take a crisis where then politicians have no choice but to do something. That certainly is not the ideal, but it certainly has been the trend in the way politicians deal with the biggest problems facing this country.
What do you think federal lawmakers in the House and Senate can learn from our local leaders at the grassroots community level when it comes to budget planning and resources?
Well, I mean, to some extent, local governments do a better job. They deal with what they have, but I would look beyond just government, too. I'd look to, you know, how do businesses deal with financial situations? How do households deal with financial institutions? I mean, these politicians are people, too. They deal with these things in their everyday lives. It's no different. I mean, they're stewards of taxpayer money. They are there to serve the people, not the other way around. And so much of what we hear and see these days feels like it's the other way around, like the people are reporting to them. Not the case.
Well, as you shift more of the challenges to nonprofits, to volunteer organizations, that is a big burden for them. And they, too, have a bottom line that they have to make work. How much can volunteer fuel this economy and make these challenges work out when you look at some of these basic conditions to live?
Yeah, I mean, is it fueling the economy? Perhaps, at least indirectly. What it's doing through so many of these quiet organizations here and around the state and around the country, what they're doing is returning dignity to people's lives, finding a job, promoting work, those things that make a difference, bringing families back together. We've seen a breakdown in family, and that's part of the problem, and government seems to have filled some of that vacuum of the family breakdown.
Well, Rick, we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
To try to make that better.
Rick Graber is president and CEO of the Bradley Foundation based in Milwaukee, and he recently wrote an op-ed titled, "Washington Can't Solve Our Problems, But Civil Society Can." I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.